Hello and welcome to Messiah's Upper Room Podcast. Each week, you'll join Messiah's Upper Room Bible Study Class led by Pastor Jim Oddie. This week, we continue our series over the Gospel of John. Enjoy.
Okay, well, let's get into our lesson for this morning, which could be, not promising, could be the end of John. I know. We all may grieve this. I don't know. We may postpone it. We'll see what happens. Okay. All right. So we're in John 19, and we'll begin at verse 38. So what's happened so far, of course, is that Jesus died. The crucifixion had its effect, and so now the question is, what do we do with the body on the cross, okay, or the bodies on the cross? Because what throws a bit of a monkey wrench into the normal way things would have been handled is the fact that this is the Passover. And so the Passover brought with it additional restrictions and requirements ritually or traditionally in terms of Jewish people, and in particularly when it came to burial. Okay, so we go to verse 38 of chapter 19. After these things, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission. So he came and took away his body. Nicodemus also, who earlier had come to Jesus by night, came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths with spices, as was the burial custom of the Jews. Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new tomb in which no one had been laid. So because of the Jewish day of preparation, since the tomb was close at hand, they laid Jesus there. So John, again, in his sort of way that is particular to him, again, reveals to us some details that some of the other gospel writers don't mention. But when we want to know a little bit more about Joseph and about this exchange that takes place, we have to look in Luke 23. So if you follow along, I have it written there for you, verses 50 to 53. Now there was a man named Joseph, a member of the council, a good and upright man, who had not consented to their decision and action. He came from the Judean town of Arimathea and was himself waiting for the kingdom of God. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body. Then he took it down, wrapped it in linen cloth, and placed it in a tomb cut in the rock, one in which no one had yet been laid. So what do we learn about Joseph that John didn't really go into the detail, but Luke, being the physician, he was a man of great detail. What were some things we learned about Joseph from Luke? He was a member of the council. Yeah, he was the council that they're referencing is the Sanhedrin. And so that was the Jewish ruling council. And so it does reveal that there was a division of thought and action in terms of how they felt about Jesus. They all felt uncomfortable with Jesus, but the fact that maybe there was a vote, or maybe there was just the large group of people said, we're going to do it no matter what anybody else wants. The high priest was, of course, in on it too, and probably would have swayed the vote. But it is kind of interesting that he mentions that about Joseph. John also mentions that about Nicodemus, but we already knew that about Nicodemus going back to our study in John 3, when Nicodemus came to Jesus at night, remember, and he was saying, we know you're a man from God. We know you're a teacher come from God, because nobody could do what you're doing and not be from God. So he was struggling, too, with this whole idea of who Jesus was and what Jesus's ministry was to be about. But it's interesting that the thing that jumps off the page for me here is that Nicodemus before didn't want to be counted among Jesus' followers in public. That's why he came to Jesus by night. He was fearful of what his peers would say and do, and perhaps they would excommunicate him from the council. Don't know, that's just a little bit of conjecture. But then with Joseph as well, he was secretly a follower of Jesus, but he didn't want anybody to know that, again, for fear of what might happen. Notice now that changes. They both are being identified. They both, in some sense, go to Pilate to be publicly identified. And now they would be noted in public as somebody who would have cared enough about Jesus, perhaps even a follower of Jesus, to take his body and to prepare it for burial. And so I just kind of threw a question in there from that perspective, is what does it take to shift from being a hidden believer to one who is willing to be identified in public? What does that take? I mean, can you relate to the idea of wanting to keep your faith and maybe your affiliation with Jesus private? Can you relate to that? How so? I mean, it doesn't have to be now. Maybe it is now, but maybe at some point in your life, you realized that it might cost you something to be identified as a Christian. Maybe it would cost you friends. Maybe there'd be some pressure placed on you, or maybe you just would be called a goody two-shoes and you didn't want that. I mean, you know, I don't know what it is. Yeah, Kathy.
I kind of opposite perspective. Okay. I sometimes don't want that because my behaviors may not be what they should be.
Okay.
I hate to lead somebody astray and they say, well, she claims to be Christian. If I'm having a bad day, I don't want people to know.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be the witness I'd want to get.
So kind of the fear of being called a hypocrite idea. I mean, that's not what you said, but...
If you're acting stupid, you're having a bad day and making bad choices, you really don't want people...
Mm-hmm.
And we all have bad days. Maybe that's the day you hide.
Yeah, I don't think that our faith life makes us smarter. Have you noticed that? Stupidity and faith still are... But I get what you're saying is that if you publicly say that you're a Christian, then the eyes are looking at you that somehow that would make a difference in your life and maybe your behavior and maybe how you act and all those things. I don't know that that's a bad thing, really, when it comes down to it. Maybe it's a good thing, you know.
Example is I would never put a fish on my back of my car.
You what?
I would never put the symbol of the fish on the back of my car.
This is correct. We have talked about that in this class, that... Fish on the back of the car doesn't make you any better in the Walmart parking lot than anybody else, right? Yeah, that's a good point. Again, it is kind of looking at it from the other point of view, but it still goes to the issue of then the result being out of a little bit of fear there that I don't want to bring a bad report onto the faith, okay? But then the result of it is I don't have any report, right? Then I'm not claiming any affiliation or any loyalty or faith or whatever it is to Jesus. Yeah, Sharon.
I think a shift may be as you are longer a Christian, your faith develops more and more. You're more at ease to share your faith than when you were.
Oh, maybe when we're older. You know, I wonder why.
For me now,
yeah.
Here than when I was a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Maybe so. Maybe we're a little bit more secure in it, or maybe we just don't care what other people think anymore, do we? Yes. I've noticed that change a little bit in me. I used to be like way over the top, too concerned about what other people thought and what other people thought of me. Now I just care about what other people thought, right? I care some about what people think of me, but not as much nearly anymore. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Doris.
Well, this is kind of a confession of my sins.
Oh, good. We're here for you, Doris.
Not all of them, just a segment.
Oh, okay, just one of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I have this hairdresser, and she has a very different, I'll leave it like that, lifestyle. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she tells me she has read the Bible more than any preacher has ever read, but she does not believe in Jesus and she does not believe in heaven.
Yeah.
And so I was there Wednesday and she was cutting my hair, and every time I go, she starts talking about that.
Yeah.
About her disbelief and how her little grandson has wants to know about God. And
yeah.
I said, well, you need to buy your little grandson the sweet books about Jesus, because he's only four.
Yeah.
And he thinks God's a mean person.
Oh, yeah. So that's a sad thing.
Yeah. I said, buying the little... Oh, no. We're not reading those long stories. Anyway, my long story short, I finally... Now, look, she does this every time I go.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally just said, Tracy, I don't want to talk to you about this anymore. Now, that's my bad. I mean,
her scissors in her hand.
Yes, that's what I said. I didn't want to make her mad, but I just said, I can't talk to you about this anymore because you and I are on such opposite sides of the fence.
Yeah.
And she agreed, but that wasn't a very good witness on my part, but like Cindy said, she was
going to... Well, she is holding sharp objects, you know, I mean, there is... And maybe some of it's more of a timing thing, actually, than anything else. It might be.
And then I got to thinking, well, maybe she wants to hear more, and that's why she... Because I had those to her, too,
mm-hmm.
and I just asked, I said, does Tracy ever talk to you about it? She said, no, never.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, maybe she... I don't know. Maybe she knows...
So, you're... yeah.
She knows my whole background.
Maybe you're the one.
But I feel bad about it.
Well, should we forgive her, or should we just, should we let her wallow in her sin over there? No, I get that, but sometimes it is a timing thing, all right? Sometimes there is an antagonism that is there, but I think sometimes, and I, this is my suspicious nature, or maybe just how I look at things, is that I always think that when somebody puts up defenses against God's grace, there's something underneath it that's fueling that. And so I have a natural curiosity that makes me wonder, I wonder what has happened to her, and maybe at the hands of church or at the hands of Christians, that would make her conclude that she has to be that way. And so probably I would say that maybe get your hair cut more often. Because, you know, there might... It just sounds like if she's not doing it with anybody but you, then it does seem that there's a connection made there, and it's not all bad if she is perturbed internally when she's with you. That does not mean you're doing something bad or anything like that. It means that the Spirit is being stirred in her when she's with you. So something's going on, and I wouldn't feel bad about that. I'd feel energized by that.
Well, to me,
does that feel bad? Does that? Okay. Yeah. Phil, you had your hand up.
So going back to the question of what does it take to shift from being a hidden believer to being one willing to be identified in public, I think it's a combination of understanding and like some courage.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is that for me, whenever I was growing up, I of course didn't have that great of an understanding of the scriptures, of the Bible. And I mean, I still to this day don't. But during my maturation process, like I made it a point to read the Bible from beginning to end, because I'd never had done that before in my in my entire life. I mean, like I read excerpts from here and there.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had different perspectives, like why is God saying one thing over here in the Old Testament, but it's something else is being preached about entirely different and loving in the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to really connect the two until I was able to take in that the entirety of the Bible,
sure, the
from
thing.
Beginning to end,
mm-hmm.
and gain a better understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And then as things started to fall into place and click, it got me more comfortable with being able to reach out and witness to other people,
mm-hmm.
Or at least just to discuss my faith with people that I've known to not hold any faith,
right,
throughout my life, for fear that they would either ridicule me or no longer want to associate with me or mm-hmm. whatever. And so that's where the courage aspect also comes in.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you. Yeah. So having the bigger picture really actually gives you a frame of reference where you're not limited to just seeing a snippet of it. Very good. Yeah.
I was reminded, did you get that email from Dr. Gregory Seltz this week?
Probably, but I just don't have time to read everything.
It was interesting. So on a different level, I think some of us can fly under the radar. He, you know, with that, the Lutheran Center for Religious Liberty.
Yeah, yeah, in Washington, D.C.
Right. About people who really do kind of stick their head up and get whacked over
yeah.
the head.
Yeah, whack a Christian is kind of popular right now. Yeah,
their faith.
Yeah,
you know, so it may come to a point where it's not as easy. Most of us don't have to deal with it, but he talked about, you know.
Well, there's something to be said for that. You know, not everybody that's opposed to Christianity has been wounded by the church. Some people have, but there's a lot of antagonism toward Christianity. Period, and there might be a bunch of reasons for that, but. You know, that's the thing, okay? That's the thing, is that it kind of comes down to, I think, in some sense, the relationship of fear to faith. So when I talk about fear and faith, I don't talk about them as mutually exclusive. I talk about them as being together, existing together side by side in a human being. So I look at it a little differently because I would say that human beings are quite capable of fear. Why do you think Jesus kept saying over and over again, don't be afraid, don't be afraid, don't be afraid? Because we are. We're anxious human beings, and anxiety is kind of part of our existence. The more insecure that you feel about anything, fear gets triggered. It just does. But the question always is what do I do with it, and do I give into it where to the point where it cripples me and paralyzes me, or can I move forward even with it? Kind of the courage idea, okay? So that's why I put it up on the board the way I did, because fear and faith they both exist in the person, but which one is trumping the other one? And I don't know that necessarily, even for as a person of faith, that I can say that I always have faith over fear. I think that we fluctuate between them. We fluctuate. And the fluctuation is just a product of how much, maybe how much security there is around us, how good I feel in the moment, you know, whether I have filled my brain all week with a lot of negativity and then I come to church for an hour and get positivity. Maybe that ratio is goofed up, you know. There's a lot of things that could factor into that. But I think to some degree we move back and forth. And so, as far as what Joseph and Nicodemus had experienced up to this point, was that the version of Jesus that they had experienced was that he was a really good person. He was a great teacher. He spoke truth in such a way that it resonated deeply with them. But then he died. And so in the minds of everybody that knew Jesus, he was kind of just the same as everybody else. Very special. Very wonderful. Right? But just like everybody else because what? He died. And until they come to terms with and witness the fact that he's resurrected, there's nothing really that would have taken them further out of the fear into faith. Except for the fact, the really cool thing is that they at least cared enough about him and about his body that they would take him and put him into a tomb. And John and Luke both mentioned this, that it was a tomb into which no one else had been laid. It was a pristine virgin tomb. Kind of an interesting sort of linkage, maybe, to the virgin birth or to some other aspects of Jesus' life. And so I don't need answers on this question. I just want to throw it out there because I think there's a lot of Christians today that are struggling with this very thing. That because there is antagonism now, and there is in some communities violence toward Christians or Christianity, the cost might be higher. The cost might be greater, right? But having given that, How does that compel me in terms of not just living my faith as a good person, but living my faith as one who's publicly identified as a Christian or Lutheran or whatever is the flavor that you attach to? Okay? So I just want you to, I kind of want that question to sit with you unanswered through the week, and hopefully it will irritate you to no end. Okay? Those are the best kind of questions, the ones that irritate you and kind of just make you kind of want to go, ooh, I don't want to deal with that question. Okay? Yeah, Lawrence, did you have your hand up? Okay. Did you have your hand up? Okay. Hand up? Yeah.
I did. I think the one thing that helped me become more vocal,
yeah,
is recognizing that I can answer questions with, I don't know.
So you feel better now because you can say, I don't know, whether when you were in the classroom you couldn't get away with that, of course, yeah.
But, you know, when people ask questions, well, why did God do this?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm okay.
Yeah.
And I think that as humans, a lot of times, we want the answer.
Yeah, sure, of course.
And that's a struggle. But being able to give my permission to... permit myself to say, I don't know the answer.
What I like to do is say, I'll see your question and raise you two questions to go with it, which I love to do. I love to ask questions. All right, well, let's take a look at a little thing here on the burial custom of the Jews. This was kind of interesting. And notice again, Jesus really got shortchanged. He should have got the full deal, you know? He really did, but the timing of his death was just, you know, have you ever had that? Somebody, you know, not that I'm going to make fun of death here, but kind of the idea of the timeliness of it. It was so inconvenient, right? Let's take a look at the burial customs. So the traditional Palestinian burial practices were, number one, a prompt preparation for burial, which included washing the body in perfumes and ointments, wrapped linen, and bound in strips of cloth with a face wrapped in cloth. So that all happened, okay? We're able to see that with Jesus. Then there would be a funeral procession with family and friends as they moved toward the family tomb. Well, you know, as Jesus pointed out in one of the other Gospels, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. He didn't have family per se and a family tomb per se, so he didn't get to have that happen. Personal effects were often placed in the tomb alongside the body. That didn't happen because I don't know if he even had anything. Some tombs included a setting for people to gather for eulogizing and lamenting. Then the procession would return to the family home where grieving would continue for the next 7 days. The death of a parent was grieved by children for a full year. That's kind of interesting. And then after the body decomposed, the bones were placed in a box called an ossuary, and then it was placed in a niche underground or in a cave. So that's how they did it in those days. And notice, really, actually, Jesus kind of didn't get much of any of that, did he? Right? I mean, he kind of was, they were sort of under the gun as far as the timing of this with because of Passover and the Sabbath and all that. So they had to kind of stash him in this tomb. It was a very nice tomb, but that was not going to be the end place. Yeah, Bob.
He got more than most people that hung on a cross.
This is true.
The ones that hung on a cross, their bodies were taken and thrown in the Kindron Valley, which is the garbage dump of Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And for him to be even buried was unusual.
That's kind of interesting because one of the words that Matthew uses for hell is Gehenna.
Which is the Kindron Valley.
Then that was that place. That was sort of like, where do they, what's the landfill, we would say today, but it wasn't much of a landfill. It was a place of fire and smoke and sulfur and all these terrible smells, and that's where they went. So he got more than a criminal would, right?
Well, his two friends on the...
And that's what did it. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And the fact that they were influential, and it suggested that they were very wealthy because the myrrh and aloe, 75 pounds, that's a highly expensive ointment. Yeah, so that was These guys, see, and again, look at the stark difference between them. Before, they didn't want anybody to know. Now they don't care. And now, in fact, they're going to reverence Jesus' body, even in death. And, you know, whoever sees us, fine. Do whatever. Okay? Yeah.
I'm intrigued by the practical side.
The practical side?
That, like, these guys are embalmers. Like, do they learn that from their family? I mean, like, they don't bring a third party in. It was just they take the body and they actually...
There might have been a corporate wisdom. You know, the Egyptians were masters at embalming. They and the children of Israel, of course, came out of Egypt. So I would imagine that there, by this time, there was a kind of a common knowledge of these things. I can't really speak beyond that. Does anybody else know anything about any of that? That might be a good thing for someone to research. Maybe the person that asked the question could research that and bring it back to us in the form of a report, maybe several weeks from now.
You would take that task on because it seems like a very...
No, I'm the one that's asking unanswerable questions here. Yeah, and so I feel inspired, Brian, to sort of welcome you to and invite you to be a part of this, okay? You think you bought it? You think you bought what I just said? Yeah. Yeah, Mary.
Okay, the Lutheran Study Bible kind of indicates to me that he was not embalmed.
Right.
That the spices that were used were just to cover the smell of the body.
Yeah, because they didn't have time. See, they had to just put him in the grave, and then they do that. But the spices would have been sort of part of it, okay, because decomposition's already occurring,
yeah.
Okay. So it's, again, a way of reverencing the body, but spices certainly would have been a part of that. So it just is kind of one of those things where this was an extraordinary situation, and it was about to get more extraordinary, okay, which the irony is not lost on that, too. They put him in a temporary tomb, and they didn't have any idea how temporary this was going to be, right? Okay, yeah, Bob.
Well, I was just going to say the Jewish tradition, even today, is to bury him very quickly.
Is it?
And then, yes.
Okay.
Within 48 hours, they're supposed to be buried. They don't embalm their...
Yeah.
As a normal custom,
right.
They don't do embalming.
Right. I wonder if... I know the Egyptians did it. When did it become an American thing? You know, the American version of burial at times is an extravaganza, the funeral and all that. And now there seems like there's more of a simple kind of idea that cremation is very popular now. Not every Lutheran, by the way, thinks that cremation is okay to do. So some churches teach that it's not okay to do. We obviously do because we have a columbarium. So anyway, okay. We can stay on that forever or we can move on, right? All right, so here we go. Now comes the good stuff, right? Next page. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one that Jesus loved. And who's that, by the way?
John.
John, yeah, that's how John describes himself. And said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we don't know where they have put him." Don't you love that statement? Now, put yourself in Mary's mind. Who might they be?
Romans.
Maybe would have thought the Romans, although I don't know if she would have thought the Romans because the Romans just did the execution and then they left. That's it. But who might else they think, she think, maybe it would have been?
The Pharisees?
Yeah, like maybe in order to preclude the possibility of the claim being made that Jesus rose from the grave, we'll just snatch the body, and then that way, then it, you know, we can say, well, he wasn't there. I mean, we don't know what she was thinking, but it's interesting that that's where her thoughts went. Her thoughts did not go to resurrection. What's interesting here is that nobody's did. And even though we go back in Matthew and the other Gospels where Jesus had foretold this, he said, you know, the day's coming when I'm going to get arrested and I'm going to die, and then 3 days again, 3 days later, I'm going to rise again. And nobody heard that, because all they heard was what? You're going to die. And it's like, you know, when you hear bad news, don't you stop listening? Isn't that what happens? We just go, blank. And then we don't hear the rest of the story. We don't even hear the good news that's a part of that. All right? So when she comes to the tomb, she's expecting to see what? Even before that, she's expecting to see the stone in front of the thing, right? And now it's not there. Well, then the panic ensues. Well, then somebody must have grabbed Jesus's body. That tells you a little bit about resurrection. It is a most unnormal event. So maybe you remember this. I think it was in the 1980s, but I could be goofed up on this. Do you remember when in the Quad Cities in Iowa, they had these massive floods with the Missouri River? Do you remember that? You know, some of you might. You might have to check this out on the History Channel, some of you. So it's because some of you weren't born then, all right? But because they had these mass floods, what happened was that some of the cemeteries got covered up with this rushing water of the Missouri River. And then what happened was it unearthed some of the graves. And so then what happened was you had these floating caskets of people, that the remains of people that were floating down the river, or they were just floating in a little eddy there. And they were having to try to figure out which casket went into which grave. And they didn't know what to do. And so what happened was when the waters receded, then they were able to tell where the grave had been. And then what they did was they would put a sign up or some sort of a placard that said, John Smith is not here. Now, it tickles me for some reason, that thought. Okay, but that's exactly what's happening here, right? It's exactly what's happening here. They go to the grave and they're expecting to see it the way they left it. And isn't that what we do when we go to a cemetery? You bury your loved one, right? You paid the fee for perpetual care. You're hoping that somebody is, you know, keeping the grass clipped and all the flowers where they need to be, or at least disposing of them well after they decompose. And you're expecting this to be a nice, peaceful place because this is the way I left it, and this is how I can remember and have the memory of my loved one. Resurrection messes that up totally. And what great news it is that it does. Okay. Peter and the other disciples started for the tomb. So they get the word from Mary. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple, who had reached the tomb first, also went inside. He saw and believed. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. What does it tell you about John and Peter, kind of the differences between them, that John got there first and he's kind of looking in, and then Peter got there second and he just goes right in? Kind of fits their personality, doesn't it? You know, the guy that got out of the boat, right, to walk on the water, he just went in. He said, I don't care, I'm going right in. And the other guy was a little bit more, you know, reticent about it. I'm not sure. I'm going to kind of wait. And then Peter goes in and then he goes in. Okay? That's just how that works. But here's what's really cool. John, it says John is saying of himself that he saw and believed, and then parenthetically he says, but they still didn't understand. The good news is you can have faith without understanding. And sometimes understanding gets in the way of faith, does it not? That's why, you know, in some sense of it, I think that's probably why Jesus said on more than one occasion, unless you have the faith of a little child. Because what does a little kid do? You can tell them stuff, and a little kid will go, oh, okay. You know, like you could tell them that the moon is made of green cheese, and they'll go, oh, wow. Right? And it's not till way later in life that that thought gets goofed up by education. So, you know, there's something to be said for that. That sense of wonder, if you will, or that sense of, and maybe it's that sense of more than you can imagine, as the Bible talks about that. And sometimes what happens in the adult life is that we're focused in on what you can see, what the evidence of something is. What? How do I know I can trust in something? Because, you know, the evidence and the data and all the things that we depend on in an evidentiary way, which is all good, can really kind of limit what you end up believing and trusting is possible in the hands of God. Well, we'll come back to that. Okay? You with me so far? So Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb. Now, notice, she doesn't go in either. She's looking. But she saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. Now, notice, the angels didn't show up when John and Peter went in there. Isn't that weird? They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." I just love that. It's this idea that you expect the body to be where it was, and if it's not, then somebody must have put him somewhere else. That's so odd. At this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't realize it was Jesus. Why not? Why not? She wasn't expecting. I mean, you know, you think humanly speaking, that would be the last thing in the world anybody would think, right? So he asked her, "Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." And she turned toward him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. So two angels show up. Whenever an angel shows up in the scriptures, it's particularly in the Gospels, but other places too, part of their showing up is to reveal the fact that the plan of salvation has moved forward. Can you think of some other times in the Bible where it talks about angels showing up?
Jesus.
Do what?
Gabriel to Mary.
The announcement to Mary. That was a pretty big angel moment. Okay. Yeah, the shepherds. That was another big angel moment.
Jesus.
Yeah. Okay. So you think, why do angels need to show up at that moment? Because humans cannot figure it out on their own. That's why. Okay? And so what angels do is they reveal to people that the salvation that we have through Christ has kind of like moved one step forward. And this is a big step, right? Resurrection is huge. When is the last time angels are spoken of that they're going to show up to explain things to humans? Judgment Day. Now, in heaven, we don't have to have stuff explained to us because we'll sort of get it. But in Judgment Day, Jesus is coming, the archangel's blowing the trumpet, everybody's showing up, okay? And that's going to be another significant step forward in salvation. Well, let's keep going here. What do you make of Jesus saying the word Mary? Great, tender moment. You know, the English doesn't really probably do it justice, but it's just you get this sense that Jesus, in his compassion for Mary, is not begrudging the fact that she didn't think anything about that he might be resurrected, right? He doesn't go into a theological study here at that moment of, don't you remember when I told you? Okay, he doesn't do that, right? It's just a great moment. He says, Mary, and he would have said it in that way of someone that cared deeply for someone and who saw that they were in distress. And when he did that, Mary knew instantly, and that cut through her fear and her expectation of that this isn't the way that I thought it was going to be. So that was an interesting little moment. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father, to my God and your God." And Mary Magdalene went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things to her. What do you make of that? Do not hold on to me. Because we can imagine in that moment when he says Mary and she says teacher, that it was all she could do to keep from just grabbing onto him and clinging to him in some way. So what do you make of this where he says, no, not going to do that at this point? What do you think? Kind of a curious thing. Phil, thoughts?
His time on the earth is short. He needs to put things into motion and say, like, hey, you know, now's the time for action. Go tell
yeah.
everyone, you know,
his purpose now was not to be the earthly guy that's going to disciple people. His purpose now is to demonstrate that he really is alive, and that's going to fuel then the evangelistic work that the disciples would have to do. There's also a little bit of sense of that, and I read this one time that I don't know, I just throw it out there, is that he was still in a glowing sense. He was still in a resurrected sense, but I don't know what to do with that. I kind of like the idea better that he was indicating to them that he is he's risen, and now the purpose changes because the earthly purpose had been accomplished, right? Life, death, resurrection. So anyway, that's just a thought. Yeah.
Something happened, or he had something to do between that time and a little bit later when he was in the upper room and invited Thomas to come and touch him.
Have you been reading ahead?
No, I don't have the thing.
That is not, I don't buy that for a second. I think you may have read your Bible before you came here. So, yeah, we're going to talk about that. Yeah, perfect, yeah. Yeah, Bob.
I was just going to comment. He was thought to be the gardener. He was in a garden. The fall took place in a garden.
Ooh.
And the resurrection took place in a garden.
Oh, see, Bob, you're so smart. That is so good.
He read ahead.
No, but I love that. You know, I always like the correlations of how the Bible puts things together. It sort of gives you the idea that maybe there's a plan. You know, maybe there's a plan.
I think it's kind of cool, though, that he could have gone. He could have gone straight to the Father. But it shows his compassion and love for Mary and the disciples. He could have started this all a little bit later, but he waited before he went to the Father and told her, hey,
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah.
All right, can you calm your fears? Now go and do this. I'm going to go to the Father.
And kind of what an affirmation of her as a woman, given the fact that in those days, a woman never would have been believed. I mean, you know, women were right up there with fishermen. Fishermen weren't believed either, okay? Tax collectors weren't believed either. I mean, so you have this crew of people who would have been the least likely to have been believed in terms of the resurrection. And Mary herself, you know, again, she's not theologically trained, so she doesn't go into some big, long thing. She just says, I have seen the Lord, which is actually a pretty big thing when you think about it. But you can see where there might have been skepticism on the part of the disciples, and that, I'm thinking, would have contributed to the fact that in the upper room, the first time, the doors were locked for fear of the Jews. So there was still fear was more the prominent experience for them, even though they might have been thinking, well, we heard this report. You know, I mean, but again, think about it. Just when something happens that you did not expect and that you were convinced that it would have to be only that certain way that he is died, and he's in the grave, and then somebody grabbed him. I mean, that's sort of that's what's called confirmation bias, where it means that you are in your own mind confirming your delusional thinking. That's what that means. And so that humans have an amazing capacity to do that. Have you ever done that before? Where you were absolutely convinced that something was the way it was, and even in the face of the truth of it, you go, oh, no, no, no. And you stick with what you think. And what you think is totally off base. I'm the only one that's done that? I'm shocked by that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Phil, one more, and then we'll move on.
Thinking back when Jesus told Mary not to cling to him, it got me thinking, well, Mary had gone through like this traumatizing experience, you know, of witnessing Jesus' death.
Yeah.
And it got me thinking of the faith over fear thing, where like if you go through something that is traumatizing or just a very like jarring, fearful experience, and then you get some reassurance or some security, mm-hmm. whatever that may be, you hold on to it, you cling to it, you stay there.
Yeah. But,
I mean, like the thing that I go back to is, well, whenever I went skydiving, I was wanting really hard to hold on to that plane whenever I was about to jump out, because it was a very fearful experience.
Yeah.
And as soon as I touched the ground, thank God, you know, I'm like, okay, I'm never doing that again. I'm staying on the ground. Like I'm going to cling to the earth.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, that's so up on the board I have the word common sense. We can now question that in your experience. Yeah. You know, I'll just erase that. That probably didn't fit there. All right. All right, well let's keep on going here. So now we get the story of what happens. Now, on the evening of that first day of the week, so this is all happening on the same day. When the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and side. The disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Again, Jesus said, "Peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, I am sending you." And with that, he breathed on them and said, "Receive the Holy Spirit. If you forgive anyone's sins, they are forgiven. If you do not forgive them, they are not forgiven." Now, Thomas, also known as Didymus, that's a word for twin, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Okay, so a couple things that sort of jumps off the page. The doors are locked for fear of the Jewish leaders. So they are in lockdown. I think we can all relate to that, right? They're in lockdown. But they're in lockdown for fear of the Jewish leaders. Did they have was there a reasonable reason for that fear? Oh, yeah. Because they saw what had happened to Jesus, the leader. And we remember Peter in the courtyard of the high priest being sort of identified as one of the followers. Here he is in the courtyard of Jesus' enemies, and it kind of makes sense that he would have said, "Not me." Again, out of what? Fear for being identified, and then whatever consequences may have come from that. So they are there. Now, in terms of their fear, does the fear mean they didn't have faith? And see, that's the struggle that we have with fear. If you say that fear and faith are mutually exclusive, if you say that you can't have fear if you have faith, and if you have faith, you're not going to have fear, yes, maybe in heaven, but they both are part of our human experience. So that's why I put them together here. These guys had faith in Jesus. They didn't know the full thing yet, right? There's incomplete knowledge. But they also, I think, were exercising common sense. It's just that sometimes common sense flies in the face of faith. And that's why sometimes as Christians we're called to act in that radical way that other people would say, "Are you nuts? Are you crazy? Don't let anybody know you're a Christian. Can you believe what's going to happen to you?" And then they quote something happening to somebody. See there? That's what happens. That's going to happen to you. See, that common sense sometimes can feed the fear, and the fear sometimes controls us more than the faith. But I would say, at least coming at it from my own experience and what I think in the scriptures, I don't think they lost their faith. I think that they were overwhelmed by the enormity of something that had never happened before, even though they had been with Jesus when he raised Lazarus from the dead, right? When he raised the daughter of Jairus, he did these amazing things, but in some ways, I think, Phil, you're right, the trauma of crucifixion was so devastating for them that that was probably what was driving them in at that moment. So here we have it. All of a sudden, Jesus shows up. Now, how did he do that if the door was locked? Because, see, that was another new thing. Jesus had never done that before. Always before the resurrection, Jesus used the door just like everybody else. Now, he did walk on water. We'll give him that. But so did Peter for a little bit. So we kind of say, well, okay, maybe a little something going there. But mostly, Jesus used the same facilities that the rest of us use in our humanness to get from one place to another. When Peter and Jesus walked on the water, they didn't not get back in the boat and walk on the water all the way to the shore. What did they do? They got in the boat, and then in the boat went to the shore. But now, Jesus doesn't need to use doors because the door is locked. And it doesn't say that the door was not locked. It doesn't say Jesus was, behold, I stand at the door knocking, hoping that you'll let me in, like that one Bible verse talks about that people talk about faith all the time. He didn't do that. So what that tells us a little bit about is that the resurrection body is different than the pre-resurrection body. And that could be part of the Jesus saying, don't hold on to me part. Don't know, but again, that could be part of that. But what does that see? What does that tell you? Well, one of the things that tells us is, and the Bible talks about this idea, that when we rise from the grave, our bodies will reflect the glory of Jesus's body, and that we would be just like him at resurrection. So you think about it from that point of view. After the resurrection, Jesus himself, his human nature, his human body, he was not subject to time and space. And we see that in the scriptures where he's like shows up and he says stuff and then he disappears. And he's zooming wherever he's going. Whereas the passage of time is indicated by the humans involved in that, and John points that out a week later, you know, 7 days later, that we're still stuck with time and space and the limitations of that. In order for us to get out of this room, we have to go through that door. We cannot materialize in the sanctuary without walking there. That kind of makes sense, doesn't it? But after the resurrection from the dead, we're not going to need that in heaven. Because heaven, there's no time. There's eternity. Isn't that kind of a cool thought? And so we get a kind of little glimpse of that, a little snippet of, oh, how amazing that's going to be when we get to heaven. So Jesus says, peace be with you, and then he commissions them. So you see, this is the first of the general commission that's given to the disciples where he says, what? He says, as I have been sent, as the Father has sent me, guess what, you guys? You are now being sent. And that includes all the ramifications of what that means. Because as Jesus was sent, for the most part, into a world that became hostile to him, we are sent into a world that is, for the most part, hostile to us. But we're not sent alone, is the beauty of it. As I have been sent in my oneness with the Father, so you are sent in your oneness with me. Well, guess what? We have to stop there. Okay, that's good. So what we'll do next week is we'll further this a little bit. So if you want to be thinking about the difference between what you can see and what you can imagine, the faith fear stuff, how common sense, science, let's see, what else do I have? Evidence, symptoms, all those kinds of things that we're hearing about in the news all over the place. Kind of be thinking about that, because I want to come back to that when we look at Thomas. Poor Thomas, such a rationalist. He lives with that forever, okay? But we'll see where that goes, okay? And then, guess what? That will be the end of John, okay? And then we'll see where we go from there. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you for our time together. Thank you for the way that your word continues to speak to us, written so long ago and yet, oh, so relevant to our lives today. And so I pray, Lord, that you would help us to kind of rethink the idea of the relationship of faith and fear, that they're kind of both present at the same time, and yet one compels us to sort of shut down and get paralyzed, and the other one compels us to speak up and step up and do all those things. So Lord, as we consider that in today's climate, and we think about what that means, the opportunities abound to share the good news that you are indeed resurrected, and that is what life, not just in this life, is about, but even more significantly, the life that's to come. So be with us this week, dear Lord. Bless us, keep us close to you until we're together again. And we pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Messiah's Upper Room. Here at Messiah Lutheran Church, our mission statement is sharing his light. That means sharing the light that is Jesus Christ and telling others about his gospel. If you want to join us in that mission, please share this podcast with someone that may want to come and better know the light of Jesus. Use one of our past episodes as a starting point to start a discussion with someone, or use a past series as a personal Bible study or devotional for your family or small group. If we've given any value to you at all, consider leaving this podcast a rating and review on iTunes. That will help us climb the iTunes rankings so we may better spread the reassuring good news of Jesus Christ and continue to share his light with anyone willing to listen. Thank you again so much for listening, and until next time, may God bless you throughout your week. Bye.